Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. I started a new series on Keynote called Keynote America, but actually, rethinking it, it probably should be called Keynote Americas, because there are, of course, two Americas, an upper-class America, a prosperous America, and an underclass America. I'm guessing that most of our audience are of that upper-class America, and the middle class seems to be disappearing. There was a stat on X that I saw recently suggesting that 4 out of 10 Americans are unable to comfortably pull together $400. One in four Americans have saved nothing for retirement. It's an astonishing statistic, I think, for upper class or upper middle class Americans. I found this stat on the X page of my guest today, Natalie Foster. She's a political activist. She runs a group called the Economic Security Project. She's a senior fellow at the Aspen Institute, and she's the author of a new book about these two Americas. It's called The Guarantee, Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. Natalie is joining us from just over the bay in Oakland, California. Natalie, that stat that you reproduced on your X page is an astonishing one. I've seen it many times before, but it never fails to shock me.
Yeah, it's so true. First, I just want to say it's really great to be here, Andrew. I've admired your work for a while. It is shocking that so many people live in precarity. And frankly, what that stat doesn't show is just how much debt people owe. That is partly why there's nothing saved for retirement. You take out debt for your healthcare. You take out debt for your home. You take out debt for your car. And then you also take out debt for college. We're talking today and this week, college in many places will hit $100,000 a year. A number that is unfathomable. Americans owe trillions of dollars in college debt. And all of this gets worse when you parse it by race. It is harder and worse for Black Americans, for people of color who have had decades of this sort of precarity as well. So it's not a pretty picture, and it explains why people feel insecure. And when we feel insecure, we can't trust and we feel shame. And it's a hard place for democracy like that.
But of the two Americas, Natalie, that's a sort of a cliche, we feel insecure. I'm guessing that a lot of the people, particularly voting for the MAGA movement, for Trump, aren't necessarily part of that America. So you talk about a precarious America. There's this new class called the precariat. Mm-hmm. Does this reflect the new architecture of American capitalism, or has it always existed?
This reflects the outcome of the last 50 years of economic policymaking that has been summed up by three tenets: total faith in the market, zero faith in government, and people left pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. You can call it trickle-down economics or Reaganomics or neoliberalism. Call it what you want. That is how both sides of the aisle governed for the last 50 years. And that is what has left us debt, indebted, broke, and our democracy on the brink. And a lot of people very open to an authoritarian message that says, I'm going to come in and fix this for you.
And yet, you mentioned African Americans. Many of them vote, or most of them seem to vote Democrat for Biden. So politically, how is this manifesting itself? This insecurity, this broader insecurity, this uncertainty, this precarious economy where you have an increasingly shrinking middle class and a tiny upper class and everybody else in this underclass.
Well, I think you see it. We see it all around us. We see it in, you know, the demise of institutions when people don't trust political parties or churches or civic institutions. You know, we see it in the openness to authoritarian messages. We also see it in the way people are quick to judge and look for answers to in messages that are xenophobic, saying it's actually this guy's fault over here. It's this immigrant's fault. It's this person who's different from you, trying to explain why we live in the world we live in today. That's the manifestation we see. But my book is about something different, right? My book is saying that we have seen a sea change in how we do things over the last few years. And what was once understood to be pie in the sky, an America that could be the economy we deserve in the richest nation on earth, in the richest moment in history, that is now something that's actually possible. The groundwork has been laid for years. And in the last few years, we've seen policymaking that turns that old story on its head and says that government has a role in ensuring a basic floor so that people can live the lives of dignity and agency that they deserve.
You talk about pie in the sky. It's probably given the American metaphor. This is apple pie in the sky, isn't it?
That's right.
So I take your point, and we've had so many shows on this that a lot of it sounds probably very repetitive. It certainly sounds repetitive to me and to many of our audience. We don't need to go over all of it, although the narrative is controversial. I'm not sure everyone would agree with you. But anyway, leaving that aside, let's get to the guarantee. You said that America now has the infrastructure, the foundations for establishing a new economy. Explain what you mean by that.
That in 2020, something unimaginable happened as we descended as a nation into the chaos of the raging pandemic. And thanks to the architects who'd laid the groundwork for years, a very different kind of policy making happened. So to give you examples, we saw the National Guard be mobilized and put free vaccines in people's arms. We saw tests for the virus be mailed out to people free of charge. We saw healthcare essentially free. We, in fact, during that period, had the lowest uninsured rate in American history, despite millions of people losing their jobs overnight and a very long history of our jobs being tied to healthcare. That is a healthcare guarantee. In the pandemic, we saw, instead of millions of people losing their housing when they were thrown out of work overnight and lost their income, which is what people feared, instead, we saw the beginnings of a housing guarantee. We saw the government send rental assistance to keep people in their homes, an eviction moratorium that made sure people couldn't be kicked out. We saw governments purchase hotels and move the unhoused in off the streets, giving them a room of their own and a key to that room. That's some man on the moon level spirit when it comes to the housing crisis, getting us closer to a housing guarantee. In the pandemic, we saw the government mail checks to every parent in America with no strings attached as part of the expanded child tax credit. And those parents used those checks to make sure their kids were fed, to make sure rent was paid, and sometimes to even sock money away for retirement. That gets us closer to an income guarantee. So the point I'm making in the book is that these ideas are here now. There is a sea change, and it's something we need to build on, not do away with.
It's a very interesting argument, Natalie. Are you suggesting then that in 2020, the pandemic created a kind of emergency or condensed New Deal, or equivalent to what happened in the 30s and the building of a state which created a safety net for everyone in the midst of a catastrophic economic depression?
Indeed, that is exactly what I believe, you know, history will judge this moment as sort of a new deal. And it wasn't a surprise or an accident. I believe that the end of trickle-down economics was in 2008 when the crisis hit, the housing crisis and the economic recession that would come with it. And it was clear at that point that the 50 years of economic policymaking prior to that had not spread the gains of that era widely and had left us indebted, broke, and, you know, in our democracy, frankly, on the brink. And so there is something new emerging, and we as a nation have a choice at at this point? Do we pursue sort of a more austere authoritarian economics, or do we usher in an economic system, a post-neoliberal system that ensures abundance, that makes sure that in this richest moment on earth, in the richest country, that we have what it takes to create abundance.
Now, so Nathalie, actually, you're beginning to sound like your friends in Silicon Valley. I know they're not really your friends. The idea of assuring abundance is something we've been promised before. I'm always a bit wary of it. And I'm curious about.
Do you think it's possible?
Sorry, go on.
Do you think it's possible?
Assuring abundance. It sounds sort of creepily utopian. It sounds like the kind of thing that might come out of Google or Facebook. But that's another subject. Let's go back to 2020 because, I mean, politically, of course, like me, you're a progressive. You're certainly no great fan of Donald Trump. But are you suggesting that in 2020, which was the end of the Trump presidency, that Trump and his MAGA Republicans had anything to do with this new world, this post neoliberal world that emerged in America during the pandemic?
Absolutely. I think that in 2020, you saw candidates unlike candidates we'd seen in my lifetime. You saw Donald Trump and you saw Bernie Sanders running on both edges of their party with an economic populist argument saying the system is rigged and I'm going to fix it for you. Obviously animated by very different values, but you would then see Trump start to do things that broke with the orthodoxy of the 50 years prior. It was Donald Trump who put Operation Warp Speed into existence, which said government has a role in creating this vaccine. We're going to procure it and we're going to speed up the R&D and we're going to make sure every American gets it free of charge. You saw Donald Trump start to send some of the first stimulus checks out that are really a challenge to a neoliberal orthodoxy that says pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And he also would pass a tax code that would be a giveaway to the biggest corporations and the wealthiest Americans and would ensure and lock in years of further income inequality that, you know, during a period when the market was doing really well, that very few Americans would actually see any of those gains. So there are all kinds, and all of it, of course, tinged with a xenophobia and racism that really further divided this country. But you would then see Biden come in, who probably was the most moderate of the bunch. I think of 2020 as a pretty extraordinary moment for the Democratic Party. It was the primary of ideas. You had candidates running on some of the biggest, boldest economic ideas that we've seen in my lifetime, all of them challenging the orthodoxy of the last 50 years, from a housing guarantee to a healthcare guarantee to an income guarantee and a guarantee of good work. And the most moderate of the bunch would win, but it was a moderate who was pre-neoliberal, a moderate who, by virtue of the fact he's 81 years old, actually remembers a period of time when the American government played a stronger role in shaping markets so that they are competitive, to create the middle class, to help support a power balance like trade unions. And it would be this president who would usher in an extraordinary shift of economic policymaking when faced with the greatest crisis of a generation.
And Nathalie, how would you respond to the argument that, you know, maybe some of the things you're saying have some truth, but the COVID crisis was completely unexpected. No one knew what was happening. The government panicked, maybe correctly or maybe incorrectly. There was a huge amount of money sent out in the first year or two. The nation became obsessed with this pandemic, which in my view at least wasn't quite as bad as it was presented, but that's another issue. And then it kind of went away and everything went back to normal. That none of the structures of, I mean, I take your point that it proves that the government is capable of acting in a national emergency, but it didn't really change anything. The money was there, it got spent, there isn't any more money there now. Is there any credibility in that argument?
Absolutely. It's the argument that says things can't change. This is the status quo. The economy is like the weather. It's something that happens to us. Just put up your umbrella a little higher. The economy is like a house. It is a thing we build every step of the way. We make decisions and we get the outcome and we lay the plans and the blueprints. And that is really, you know, where we are. I would say the Milton Friedman quote, ironically, has been very inspiring to me, that says that it's only in a crisis, perceived or actual, when progress is made and ideas that are lying around are picked up and moved forward.
You were part of the Obama, you ran the Obama's digital stuff. So you were around in the Obama years. That was, of course, I can't remember who said it, but someone suggested within the Obama team that should never waste a good crisis. And that crisis of 2008, 2009 seemed another opportunity to break the stranglehold of neoliberalism, but it didn't seem to really change very much.
I think it was the end of neoliberalism, but it took us as a nation a minute to realize that. That is the period where you would see Occupy Wall Street. You would see kids sitting in saying, we are the 99%. We cannot afford to, go to college, buy a home. The American dream is not available to us. And it would spread like wildfire around the country. And it would start to create a consciousness that would say something different is afoot. That's when you'd start to see activists laying the groundwork for
You say it spread like wildfire. Occupy Wall Street went away. It seemed to me, at least, to go away as quickly as it appeared. And since then, the country has elected Trump and then Biden, both in their own way a remarkably conservative and very old politicians without any real new ideas. So I don't see any evidence that this spread in your words like wildfire, especially Occupy Wall Street. Where's the legacy of that?
Okay, Andrew, I disagree with the idea that Joe Biden doesn't have new ideas. Just this week, the Biden administration has canceled yet another several billion dollars of student debt, meaning that hundreds of thousands of people who have been walking around this country with a ball and chain because of their college degree now have room to breathe. You have people who have gone from $15 an hour low-wage jobs to $25 an hour with benefit jobs coming out of the IRA in manufacturing plants in the South, jobs that were never, that were not going to just happen without government saying this is something that's really important to us. I'll just say the IRA, I've been tracking climate legislation for my career. That's kind of how I got started. And it was always a very neoliberal understanding of how you do this. You put a price on carbon, that's it. The IRA was an industrial policy. Now, it's called the Inflation Reduction Act because inflation was the great boogeyman, the great economic concern of that time. But what it is at its heart is an industrial policy bill that says, this is where we want to go in America. We want to be a clean energy leader and we want to do it with jobs right here. That is a new idea. I have never heard a president talking like that in my lifetime.
We are speaking with Natalie Foster, author of a very interesting new book, The Guarantee: Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. When it comes to, she's talked about challenging orthodoxy in her ideas, challenging the orthodoxy of neoliberalism. One publication that challenges intellectual orthodoxy is our sponsor, Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics. Excellent new publication. Going to run a short feature on Liberties, and then we'll be back with Natalie Foster to talk more specifically about the details of the new world that she's confident is just on the horizon. So don't go away, anyone. We'll be back in a second.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable, Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with Natalie Foster, the author of The Guarantee, important and really interesting book. I'm sure it's going to be quite controversial too. A book about trying to get inside the fight for America's next economy. Natalie, in the first half of the show, you laid out your broad arguments. Let's get into some details. I know that you've written extensively about states testing no strings cash as part of their social safety net, and this is a post-COVID thing. Tell me about this and how it proves, in your view at least, that there is now a new deal in America.
Absolutely. Let me tell you a story of a young student at Stanford University sitting in the Stanford library reading the last book of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., taking notes in the margins. And that man, student, was Michael Tubbs. And he would take that dog-eared book of Dr. King's with him to Stockton, California, where he would become the youngest mayor, one of the youngest mayors in American history. And he would pull out that book where Dr. King had talked about ways we can abolish poverty in America. And he would say, I want to demonstrate these ideas right here. He would launch a demonstration of guaranteed income, a pilot of guaranteed income, where 125 families in Stockton would receive $500 a month with no strings attached. The media would take notice. People would come to Stockton and mayors would start to text and say, I want that in my city. And it would spread like wildfire. He opened up his playbook, he open sourced it and invited people in. Now 140 cities across America are piloting a guaranteed income to show what it could look like in America. Then the pandemic would hit and the Biden administration would look for ideas and they would send stimulus checks, but they would also pass the expanded child tax credit, which would send $500 a month to families with two children, just like was happening in cities across America. And so this is an example. And the thing we know from both the child tax credit checks that went to every parent and from the demonstrations across the country is that when people have something as simple as $500, they have more room to breathe. They feel less stress. They feel less anxious. And in many cases, find full-time work at higher rates because they have time to invest in themselves. And that is a profound shift simply with income. Imagine it across the board. If we guaranteed a floor in America that would give people the room and space to have the freedom and the dignity that they deserve.
Yeah, we did a show a couple of months ago with a friend of mine, Susan Danziger. You may know her. She's developing independently on her own a guaranteed minimum or a guaranteed income pilot in Hudson, New York. She's from a family of means. I take your point, and it is an interesting experiment, especially in a place like Concord over the bay from us in California. But it's only, Natalie, it's only $500. That's not, I take your point that it may indeed, of course, change people's lives who don't have that $400 for emergencies, but doesn't it in its own way concretize the inequality in American capitalism? It creates a kind of weirdly feudal infrastructure where half the country is living off $400 or $500 a month, which is given to it, and everybody else is making, or it's probably 80% of the country, and the other 20% are making huge amounts of money. Does that concern you at all?
Well, first, I really love Susan and think that the work they're doing in Hudson is spectacular. One of the other things they did was help forgive medical debt across the city, where people who have gone deep into debt just to get the care that they deserve, given our broken healthcare system. And so it's a reminder how these things build on one another. And I really like what
and
she's
it is
doing.
Worth reminding everyone. I'm not sure she always wants to hear this, but a lot of the things she's doing is financed from venture capital. Her husband and good friend of mine, Albert Wenger, is a partner at Union Square Ventures. So it's a sort of surreal recalibration or reorchestration of of tech wealth filtering down or trickling down?
Well, what I see them doing, and Albert has written an important book and has been a really big thinker in the guaranteed
income. Yeah, and Albert's been on the show. In fact, I helped. I was one of the people who helped sort of conceptualize the book. Is The World After Capital? Right. He's been on the show many times.
Albert believes in a world where abundance is possible, for sure. What I see them doing is not trickling down, but is instead supporting the R&D for policy change that would actually level the playing field in America. That's what I see them doing, and people like them. And that's actually, I see people like, I spent yesterday with a group called the Patriotic Millionaires. This is a group of people who are saying, I was born lucky, or I got lucky with the business. I, you know, I worked hard, but also the luck was there, and I've made a lot of money, and I want to live in a functioning country. And so I'd like to pay enough taxes that allow me to live in a functioning country. And it's a really powerful thing to hear.
Do you think, though, that the elites, and I don't want to pick on Albert and Susan because they're friends of mine and they're good people. I don't know anything about your Patriotic Millionaires, but are people really willing to make the kind of sacrifice, the elites in this country, to change everything? Earlier this week, I did a show with a woman called Victoria Newhouse. She has a new book out about housing America and changing, and she's politically on the same side as you, but she's also from one of the wealthiest families in America, from the Newhouse family. And when I suggested to her, oh, well, maybe you should give up some of your real estate, she has lots of properties all over New York, she didn't seem that keen. Does the progressive elite on the coasts, and you're all too familiar with them, Natalie, I'm not suggesting you're part of them, in San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York, the kind of people who are financing a lot of these schemes, do they need to really make the kind of sacrifices that will hurt them?
I think that's a very good question. Now, I believe we can live in a country with enough to go around where people can still live a life they're accustomed to, a good life. But this is a moment couple of weeks ago where Oxfam, the international NGO, put out some data that said, if we don't change tax policy, we will have our first trillionaire in the next decade. Now, Andrew, I had to do a little digging to really understand.
I would think that would happen actually before the next decade.
A trillionaire. That is a million millions, right? That is a thousand billions. That is one person controlling more wealth than many, many countries, including Ireland.
And it's worth noting that, I don't know, it depends on the current state of the stock market and the price of Amazon and Tesla and SpaceX. But Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are both worth, on a good day, over $100 billion. So they're not that far away, just it's 10x their current wealth.
So we cannot live in a world where we rely on the good charity of people and their whims. That is not a world. That is, you know, many people I daily get to interact with people who are using their good fortune to make the world a better place. And that is very important. I think philanthropy is incredibly important, but that won't solve our problems. It has to come from policy shift.
I'm not, you know, I want to believe in what you're saying, but I just don't see it. In the upcoming election, we know what Trump wants, or maybe we don't know what he wants, but we know what his shtick is. And Biden seems increasingly exhausted and increasingly shy to even show off the stuff which at least you believe he's accomplished. How does this manifest itself politically? There's been talk of a third party that often gets nixed by progressives because they don't want another Ralph Nader situation. But surely this needs to manifest itself in politics, because if what you're saying has any truth, I don't see any evidence, certainly in the upcoming presidential election.
Well, I think the evidence, you are absolutely right that we have to connect the dots between so much of what has happened, between the fact that today, yesterday, hundreds of thousands of student debtors who did exactly what they were told to do in this country, go to college and take out large amounts of debt to do so, woke up, with a zero in their account, a zeroing out of how much they owed. And the freedom that comes from that, the possible entrepreneurialism, the pursuing of one's dreams and risks and possibilities that comes from having economic security. It's our job to connect those dots to policy change that happens when you have an administration like the one we have, and when you have states, you know, doing the work that they're doing. So I think that is the work to do. There's still a lot of time between now and November, and the stakes honestly couldn't really be more different in the worldviews that these two candidates are laying out.
It needs to be something radically different, though, doesn't there, Natalie, in this new world that you're imagining? You can't just be a return to the New Deal and a strong state, which was very much of a 20th century phenomenon. What is, you talked about something called the New Deal. What gets beyond the New Deal? What kind of language do we need? It's not enough just to pay off student debt. I take your point. Maybe it will change people's lives or some people's lives. But it's not going to fundamentally alter the architecture of the economy or society. What's really new about what's about to happen in the 2020s?
What's really new about what's to happen in the 2020s? You know, one of the places I see a new idea is in the care economy. For so long, we understood care, right? The ability to have a caregiver, have care for your children, have care for elders or people with disabilities as a personal responsibility in an informal market that was pretty broken and that was like unfixable. We now understand that care is infrastructure, that it is the infrastructure that actually enables all work in this country to happen. That was laid abundantly clear during the pandemic. When you had caregivers who were not able to come to work because they lived in a group house or they took the subway, and care people who needed the care who were left at home trying to work their jobs and, you know, keep their kids. It was fundamentally broken, and it became clear how important this job was. And in this example, you have two sides of a market, right? You have families that need to be able to afford the care. And anyone who's had a kid recently knows how astronomically high care is, $40,000, $50,000 a year for childcare. And then you have caregivers that need to be paid well, paid a wage that allows for them to put food on the table and to pay rent and do the things they need to do. And ideally even work that comes with benefits and protections in this country, which so much of that work doesn't. And so the idea that care is infrastructure, I think, is a new idea. And just this week, you know, you saw a lot of caregivers and advocates at the White House saying we need a care guarantee. You have states like New Mexico who are taking the money that was given to states as part of the pandemic relief and ensuring that everybody gets free childcare in New Mexico, sort of being the laboratory of democracy for this guarantee economy that I believe we can have in this country.
Although that, again, goes back to relying on government for care.
I don't think it's relying on government for care. It's government to shape the market, to say, we've given it a good shot, 50 years of just letting the market solve its own problems. And this is the best we got, where I have a kid and I pay $50,000, you know, for somebody to watch them know that there is a better way forward. And I'm going to have a strong, you know, hand in shaping the market, making sure it's affordable on one side and wages are high.
We heard the same on medical, the reforming the medical system. The Obama, your administration, got some of the smartest people in the world, and they did a reasonable job, but it's still not entirely convincing. This stuff is hard to fix, isn't it?
It is hard to fix, but let me just talk about that for a second. So we passed the Affordable Care Act 14 years ago, March of what would it have been, 2010. And at that time, if you remember in history, the Tea Party, which were, you know, a direct line between QAnon of today and the Tea Party of yesterday, were in every disrupting every town hall across the country saying, I don't want government in my healthcare, making up imaginary things about death panels and other crises. The Affordable Care Act seemed doomed. Donald Trump ran for president saying, I will get rid of Obamacare. Donald Trump had the House, the Senate, and the presidency. And you know what survived? The Affordable Care Act. Because at that point, it had already been a very meaningful thing in people's lives. It has survived hundreds of legal and legislative attacks. And just this year, we saw North Carolina, the deeply purple, quasi-red state of North Carolina, become the 40th state in the union to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. And when we hit the pandemic, and when millions of people were thrown out of work overnight, they didn't lose their health care. They rolled straight on to Medicaid thanks to the Affordable Care Act. And we saw the lowest number of uninsured Americans in history, which was defying gravity. That was not an inevitable outcome. So while it doesn't sound new and sexy, it has been a policy that's grown and expanded to get closer to a healthcare guarantee than any of us could have imagined 14 years ago when it was passed. It's not perfect. It's not the end all and be all, but it is a sign of progress.
Finally, Natalie, as I suggested, you're no fan of big tech. You had an interesting piece in Politico recently on how states can help big tech from dominating AI. But I'm guessing that if a really new world is about to emerge in the 20s that will change an America that conservatives and progressives seem to agree has gone completely wrong, will AI and will new tech, will it have a role?
Well, let me just say, I am a fan of technology that is working to make society a better place. I have actually spent the first part of my career using technology to bring people together around social change. I spent some very formative years at MoveOn.org, which was pioneering something very new in politics and in social change at the time. And that era of tech was a very optimistic, heady moment. I think Andrew, you had a lot to say during that period.
No, for sure.
Well,
we all were around in those heady days, those optimistic days.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I'm not a fan of is broken, concentrated markets that cut out ingenuity, that cut out innovation, and that mean the little guy can't do what it wants to do. And that is the tech landscape that I see today. And unfortunately, that is the landscape that is being created in this new AI moment, where it's the same players, dominant players from yesterday, poised to dominate the market up and down the AI stack. And I believe we know how to handle this. We've actually handled it many times before as a nation, whether it be the railroads and ensuring that there was, you know, equal access and how we ensure that it's laid out across the country and what are the terms of use. People still got very wealthy during that period of time, but government said, this is the rules of the road. That's not what we've done for the last several decades during Web 2.0. We've just let the market do its thing. And so I believe in this moment of the AI revolution, government has an important role to play with guardrails. And things like a public option, which is what I'm talking about in that op-ed in Politico, which is part of Scott Wiener's bill that I'm actually pretty interested in here in California, that would start to create a level playing field and actually create a public option for a cloud called Cal Compute, a public cloud that would help shape that very concentrated, dominant market.
I take your point again, but and we've touched on this before in this conversation. This in some ways is a return to trust busting from the late 19th century, from the 1930s. I'm not necessarily in a disagreement with you. My final question, coming back to AI and tech, is if we can indeed loosen the grip of big tech companies like Google and OpenAI, Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, and give this new technology, AI, which you said you're an admirer of, if not to the people, certainly to the government, if in the right hands, and this is a final question, a big question, Natalie, which maybe we'll come back to another time. Would AI in the hands of government, would it allow it to challenge the authority of professional elites, of the upper middle class that have helped create this horrible schism in American society? Could AI, if used correctly, rather than just for private self-interest of big tech companies, could it be used to make a fairer America?
I think that AI is like, is incredibly powerful, and powerful can be good and powerful can be bad. And so there's no question that there is possibility to use AI for good. So for example, right now, a lot of the way technology is being used in government services is sort of culling the roles to kick people off, looking for abnormalities to move people out. What if we shifted it and said, how do we, ensure that more people get access? Here's a very small example that I'm actually excited about. The government has rolled out, the IRS has rolled out something called Direct File, which is a public option for tax filing. Okay. And so this is significant because it is the government saying, here's a tool to file your taxes that you can use for free. And it is a challenge to the dominant corporate players who have made a lot of money charging us to do our taxes. When government knows, if we have simple taxes, government knows exactly how much we've made. So today they roll out this tool and then they figure out how to pre-populate it with the amount that the taxpayer who has paid simple taxes paid last year, and just say, check this box. Is it the same as it was? That small tweak is a huge shift and saves people hours in their day, hundreds of dollars to be able to do a simple thing like paying taxes. That is one tiny example of how technology can create a much more prosperous, abundant